What's up, Packers fans, and welcome back to another draft special edition of the Packer Report podcast, brought to you by Stadium View Bar, Grill, and Banquet Hall. We are probably dropping this, I would guess, on Friday afternoon for your weekend content needs, meaning that we are less than a week from draft day. And joining me now, and so many former titles, but formerly of the Draft Network, formerly of a number of places, and currently now with Pewter Report, which is the Tampa Bay Bucks site, is my friend John Lanyard. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ross. Thanks so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, let's just, if you don't mind, give people kind of a just who is John Lanyard. We've been doing that with, you know, the folks that we've had on during this time with the kind of draft focus. So if you don't mind kind of explaining your credentials, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, started it like most people, probably trying to cut my teeth just anywhere I could, covering NFL stuff, draft stuff, Steelers stuff. I'm from outside of Pittsburgh, and so been a Steelers guy my whole life. And so just trying to, you know, like everybody, make kind of an impression wherever you can, even non-paid opportunities to start. Bounced around a bunch of places, as everybody does who's trying to climb up in the field. Was at FanRag Sports probably the longest before they kind of shut down. The whole FanRag Sports thing shut down after hot start. But they actually shut down a couple weeks after we decided to launch the Draft Network, which was an idea that I'd had for about 5 years. Actually longer than that as an idea, but I'd been like working on it and trying to find the financial backing for it and everything for about 5 years to do a lot of the stuff that you see on the site now, the mock draft machine, the build your own big board stuff, things like that. So we're able to get that off the ground, get that up and running, experienced a ton of success in a very short amount of time, a faster pace than I really even kind of thought that would be possible, which put a lot on my plate, which I'd already been kind of working an absurd amount of hours over the years before that point had kind of come. And so now that it was hitting the ground running, there were these business opportunities and we were still a young company, and it's like trying to figure out all that kind of stuff too. So I remember telling my wife at the combine that I was just like, I don't know how much. I was just totally exhausted. It wasn't fun for me anymore. I was just fatigued in every sense of it. But as I was leaving for the combine, I remember telling her, I don't know like how much longer I'm gonna be able to keep doing this. I'm just completely burnt out. I don't love it like I used to because of that. And I think I was honestly trying to find a lot of my joy in life and in my work. And work just isn't meant to fill that void in your life. And so for me, it was kind of eventually it was this process of stepping away from it and stepping away from everything kind of in the field and going to do some other work in the community, working with young adults and high school age students and some ministry opportunities, but also some counseling type of stuff and just meeting one-on-one and trying to teach and from experiences and failures that I'd had with and so really just completely unplugged from the sports media world. You know, still watch football all the time because my wife and I are obsessed with football, but didn't really think I was getting back into the media field at all. I had had opportunities and job offers and stuff and really hadn't entertained many of them, just kind of saying no and, you know, moving forward and looking to see what doors are open. And then Scott Reynolds called me at Pewter Report and he tried to, you know, we talked about working there before in years past, and they needed somebody to cover the Bucks, but also they wanted to emphasize NFL draft. And at first I really wasn't sure and prayed and thought about it for a month with Britt and just thought, you know, this door's kind of seems like it's opening, and other doors we thought were going to open seem like they were closing. And so jumped at it and been at it a couple months now with them and really enjoy it and feel like work's in a kind of healthy place in my life right now. And so hoping to keep it there. And with the draft around the corner, you know, this is the toughest week. So hoping to keep it there this week, and we'll see kind of how it unfolds from there. But it's been a fun journey. And I know that was kind of a long explanation, but there's no, that was actually the short version. There's no quick version to my story in this field.
Sure. And that's, I just want you to kind of touch on what they, so I think we're part of a different generation that kind of grew up more as almost fans of a team and then had our talent sort of found. And what I mean by that is like you grew up, you started writing about the Steelers, and now I'm in charge of a Packers publication that was started by Ray Nitschke in 19, 72, and so it's difficult to kind of feign that impartiality. I don't think there's any secret around the internet that when Green Bay does well, I am happy. Mm-hmm. And you kind of are in more of that impartial situation now, where I would guess you don't particularly care one way if Tampa Bay wins or loses. What has that been like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, like, from a fan perspective, you know, I'm not like a fan of the Bucs for sure. Like, I've grown up being a fan of the Steelers, but even when I covered for the Steelers, like, I would get excited when they did well for sure, you know, but I think also it was easy for me, and I don't think this is easy for everyone, but I think it was easy for me, and maybe it's one of my few strengths in the field, is that I don't have any issue kind of being able to be impartial and tell it like it is, even in regards to the team that I root for, where I think that's a huge struggle for a lot of people in the media. So it didn't bother me too much with the Steelers. And now with the Bucs, you know, it's not bothering me as well. I think with the Bucs, it's almost a little bit more, because Bucs fans have no idea kind of if I'm on their side or not. And they'd like to know that I'm on theirs. You know what I mean? Like, so I think if anything, it's kind of like you're going out of your way a little bit to let them know you are on their side. And I don't think it's in a way that would put my credibility in question, but just in a way that, like, yeah, like, I cover the team and I absolutely want to see them do well. Like, not only because it's great for us and for the site when the team doing well and good things are happening and more games are being played and they're going to the postseason. Obviously that's all great for us, but because it's fun, it's way more fun to cover something that's successful than something that's a failure. And so, I think that I don't try and hide that part of it at all for me. Like, I would love to see the Bucs do well. I'm super excited about Tom Brady and, you know, all that it could mean for the next couple of years for the Bucs. So I think they're on the right path, and I'll definitely be rooting for him to do well, but it won't stop me from, you know, telling it like it is when it needs to be told either. You know, that's part of the job as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think that's something that is lost in covering of teams. I mean, it is not fun, and I've never had to do it, but it's not particularly fun to do the 4-12 thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's you're complaining about the same stuff, you're writing about the same stuff, speculating about coaches and their job futures is never fun, because it's human beings and it's people that you especially once you become access media, you're literally working with them every single day. I mean, they're not necessarily coworkers, but they're colleagues. They're people that help you do your job and stuff like that. So it gets to be a little bit more complicated than that. But yeah, let's kind of dive in to this NFL draft. I think a draft that is a little bit different for Brian Gutekunst, just in the sense of when he took over, the Packers were not as great of a team, obviously. The opportunity to move around a little bit, but that was, I think, presented to them with some sort of middling pick, 15, 16. They ended up taking Jair Alexander, but they were picking in the middle of the round. Last year, they're towards the top half of the round. They had the 12th pick, which they used on Rashawn Gary. Now it's kind of more to business as usual. In general, the years I've been following the Packers, they're usually picking between 24 and 30 to 32, usually with three NFC championship game losses since the last Super Bowl, 30 has been a popular one. But what do you think is the difference? Because you're a Steelers guy. Then the approach to the draft when you are one of those relatively perennially contending teams, and frankly, you can speak, I think, to having a quarterback with a reasonably large cap hit as well, and some of the challenges that creates to roster building.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting, with the Steelers for years, one of the biggest pros has been that along the offense, they've developed talent really well, even when it wasn't, you know, high pedigree talent. And they've kept a lot of the draft picks. Like, I know they just traded a first for Minkah Fitzpatrick, but that's rare. Like, this is not a team that's moved a lot of their top picks for players and stuff. So they've kept a lot of those. They haven't even hit on all of those, though, and they've still remained a competitive team. So when you have the quarterback, you have a lot of answers. You know that in full well. And so that's been a big plus for the Steelers over the years. The offensive line development was huge because they didn't spend, you know, obviously Pouncey years ago was a first round pick and DeCastro years ago as well. But as those guys have kind of developed into studs, you know, guys like Ramon Foster is undrafted and Alejandro Villanueva undrafted and developed into a tackle at an older age, and Matt Filer last season playing great at right tackle. So they've just been able to develop talent really well in the offensive line, which has allowed them to use a lot of resources elsewhere. So the offense has been not really a big part of the problem. Defense, they spent basically all their draft capital on, and it didn't really come together until last season, which is obviously when the offense completely fell apart. So they just kind of got to get things on the right track on both sides of the ball. But one of the things that's key about it is you got to hit on your draft picks. You know, there's just no way you can be as successful as you need to be if you don't hit on your draft picks. And the Steelers have hit on enough of them in it probably actually the last 5 years has been a little bit rougher. But before that, they'd hit on so many that the roster was still strong enough to withstand missing some in recent years. And then it looks like they've, you know, TJ Watt and Devin Bush are kind of riding the ship in the right direction for them now moving forward. But that's the key, man. You can't miss on a lot of draft picks on those cheaper contracts if you're going to continue to have a winning team built around a quarterback with a big paycheck.
For sure. And that's, I mean, it's interesting how the two teams have kind of mirrored each other since Super Bowl 45. And you talk about, mm-hmm. A Steelers kind of almost a mini dynasty that looked like it might be bubbling up between what I would call like the McGinnis Patriots and then the full on Brady Patriots, you know, that time between the 01, 02, 03, 04, you know, Pats, and then the,
right,
obviously the 07 Pats lost. And then this other iteration that won a couple of Super Bowls late in Brady's career. In the middle of those two things, just people forget there was a pretty reasonably sized gap where New England did not win a title. And in that gap was some Giants titles, a Packers title, and then these Steelers titles that you kind of thought there was really something potentially building there. They lose Super Bowl 45. And as I mentioned, I mean, I think I can see real similarities in the way that they just were not making great draft choices on the defensive side of the ball. And mm-hmm. one side or the other was always seemed to be betraying the teams. And honestly, I think some of it was the loss of those two stud safeties, Troy Polamalu kind of aging out of the league and Nick Collins with that neck injury. You just saw those defenses sort of fall off a cliff they have been struggling to get back to that point. I think obviously since that time with relatively limited playoff success and not a Super Bowl appearance among the two of them from that point on. So I do see the similarities there. Where are the strengths in this draft class? I think everybody really early on in the process, especially a team like Green Bay that has a need there, identified this wide receivers group as excellent. I think people have really started to come along as far as the offensive tackles, seeing guys all the way down to like my guy, Jack Driscoll, guys that could potentially fit in this league. Where else do you find that this class is exceptional?
I think offensive tackle and wide receiver are the two right away that you come to and you're like, yeah, this is easily the best two position groups of the class. But I also think the secondary in general, I mean, you've got every type of safety and it's a good safety class. No, it's not like a star, you know, type of safety class, but you know, a good safety class that'll have plenty of starters, box guys, man cover guys that'll play in the slot like Terrell Burgess and Kayvon Wallace. The corner outside corner group is good. Again, I think Okuda is the only like lock star of the group. Henderson has the ability. Terrell has the ability. You know, there's a lot of guys that will start in the NFL at corner. There's just a ton of value in that. I think the linebacker group was really underrated for a while, but that's a really good group as well. So I think really what you edge group is bad. You know, the interior D-line group, especially after Kinlaw and Brown, just really falls off. Not very good. Interior O-line group doesn't have a lot of top talent or a lot of depth. You know, there's just a really bad interior O-line class in general. Tight end class is one of the worst we've seen in recent years. Running back class is good. I mean, there's five or six guys that should start in the NFL. I mean, if you obviously the position lacks value, but, you know, whenever you feel like drafting them, there's guys that can help and contribute there. So it's a good running back class. And then the quarterback class, you know, to me is two guys at the top, and then I'd be kind of afraid to trust anybody else in terms of them becoming a franchise guy. But, you know, I think Burrow's best quarterback I've ever scouted. And then, Tua is in that conversation, not in the conversation with Burrow, but in the conversation to be a quality starter in the NFL if he's healthy as well. And then after that, it falls off. So it just really kind of every position group's a little bit different in how what your team needs and how players fit into your team, you know, because at some position groups might be weak, but there might be a guy in that weak position group that fits the exact role that your team needs. And so therefore he ends up in a great situation and is able to blossom a little bit more. So we'll see how kind of it all unfolds, but I think that's kind of how I'd see the different position groups right now.
Yeah, I think that's you made a really good point there, just in the sense of these guys fitting, and that is a huge deal. You start to get guys that understand the schemes a little bit more as far as media types or analyst types, and understand, okay, well, this back works, you know, best in a gap scheme, and this back works here. So people are starting to understand that, okay, this guy might be RB3 for this team, but he might be RB6 for this team because he doesn't, you know, fit what they do, mm-hmm. or even, you know, like a massive unathletic offensive tackle like an Isaiah Wilson. He won't make sense for an outside zone team, but he might make sense for a power team like Baltimore or Tennessee, where we're just kind of going downhill. And I understand all that, but I'm appreciating that people are starting to get, you know, that you can't just draft a player and plug him in. A guy like AJ Epenesa, who I think you're not super high on, mm-hmm. where does he fit schematically? Like Packers fans asking me about that. And okay, well, can he play three tech in nickel, and can he play five in base? Because he doesn't bend well enough to play outside linebacker like Preston Smith, like Za'Darius Smith, even like a Rashawn Gary. So that scheme fit stuff, I think, is really, really interesting. Where do you feel like the strength in this offensive tackle class is as far as that kind of scheme? Because that's a position with wide receivers, and we will get to wide receivers, Packers fans, I promise, but it is something that we talked to death. I just had Brad Kelly on, who is just the wide receiver Dalai Lama. And so we won't beat that to death. But where do you see some of the tackles that might fit the LaFleur Shanahan McVay system? Who do you feel like make a lot of sense for Green Bay?
I think there's a bunch of guys that can work, honestly. I mean, almost all these college teams are running zone now, but nobody's running it like everybody, like these guys in the NFL either. You know, it's just the pace is just so much faster in the NFL to running zone, in my opinion. And so, I mean, I still think you have, I still think you're not talking about the top guys, obviously. You know, assuming that the top four and Josh Jones are probably off the board, Austin Jackson's probably off the board too by the time, you know, the Packers would pick. I mean, Ezra Cleveland's kind of the guy that will kind of jump out at everybody probably. And it certainly makes sense. You know, schematically, there's no reason why Ezra Cleveland can't make sense for the Packers. A little bit high for him, in my opinion. You know, but I still think, you know, good, solid player. I mean, I get it's a position of need. I wouldn't take him there, but it's not like if you took Austin Jackson, in my opinion, that would be a much bigger mistake. And so, yeah, I think he's the one that makes sense. I think there's the potential for Ben Bartsch to make sense. I mean, we're talking about a guy who has sub 33 inch arms, and I just don't know that there are many teams in the NFL that are going to see that, especially at a D3 level, and say, you know, he can hang in the NFL a tackle against the guys that you're facing. I mean, there's no bigger, when you're talking about a position transition to the NFL, there's no bigger transition than offensive line against the defensive lineman that you face in the NFL compared to what you face in college. I mean, everybody learns to rush the passer for the most part. Everybody learns to rush the passer in the NFL. I mean, and you just can't, like, you're going to be left on an island, like, at some point or another. If teams are constantly scheming you protection help, then they don't have enough options in the passing game to really make a dent in teams. So it just becomes so important for guys to be able to make that transition. So now you're talking about a kid going from D3 to the NFL with sub 33 inch arms. He's already light and definitely needs to get stronger. The Senior Bowl, some of the 1v1s are really good. Some of them are really bad. He's on the ground a couple times. You know, you don't want to see that. You know, you got to have these guys hold their water a little bit better than that. The ugly is really ugly with Bartsch right now. So, you know, the tape is obviously good. It better be, I mean, but, you know, against D3 guys. But even then, not dominant in the run game. So, again, I just want to see him get stronger. He needs work. I don't think he should play his first year probably, but eventually I think he could be a guy that maybe makes sense, and that Packers could be in a position where that is actually a fit for them in that way. Those are the two names I would throw out there. You mentioned Driscoll, so I'll talk about him briefly. I mean, I think his tape kind of surprised me. He's pretty solid on tape. I just don't know that we're talking about it. We're obviously, I mean, the strength and length concerns are real. Another guy with short arms, I think he's 33 on the dot. So I think that you're going to see a lot of teams want to move him inside, but I don't know that he has the strength hold up inside. So he may just be kind of like a Joe Haig type. You know, he plays all five positions eventually if he can snap, you know, play center, and he's a great utility backup lineman, smart. He's hardworking. He's good locker room guys. Coaches love him. You know, there's just kind of no downside. He, as a depth piece, I think he makes a lot of sense for a team, spot starter here and there. You know, I think he's a day three guy, and you might be able to get him late. But he can play. He's going to make a team, I think. So he could be another one that if you're just looking for depth at the position, makes sense. Those are the guys I would highlight. You know, I think Sadiq Charles from LSU has that potential to be that guy too. I can't speak the character stuff, you know, even looking at Dane Brugler's draft guide and, you know, talking to other people, it just like, there's just too many red flags. I think teams are so scared to draft him. I bet he's there late day three. And if he's there, you just wonder what kind of concerns teams have and whether he'll ever be able to. He has top 100 potential, but I just don't know whether he'll ever get there in the NFL.
Sure. Yeah. Driscoll for me, I mean, I had him, I think in the 90s was about where I was. So you and I are kind of splitting hairs on that. Just so gifted with his feet, mirrors really well. I thought was a phenomenal pass blocker. You're right, though. It was not moving people. I mean, he just wasn't.
Right.
And I think athletic testing wise shows you that he can move. Mm-hmm. But yeah, functional strength is going to be something that needs to get added on in an NFL weight room. Nice thing for Green Bay is, I mean, whatever you think of Rick Wagner, he is at least a usable right tackle for 2 years. He was a pretty damn good player in 16, 17, and 18. In 19, I think maybe struggled with some injuries and was not particularly good for Detroit. But as I mentioned, his 16, 17, and 18 tape are fine. He's 30. He's not 37. And so I think if you are looking for a toolsy tackle where you can give him a redshirt season, maybe a redshirt season and a half, as Wagner may break down towards the end of that second-year deal, you're in a position where you do get to at least have a chance to redshirt whichever guy it may be. I'm really hoping it's Josh Jones. Just from that standpoint, I think you maybe could get that fifth tackle. I think there's some steam on Isaiah Wilson, where if Josh Jones gets bumped down to tackle six, maybe he's there at 30, or maybe you make a move up to 25 and lose a third round pick or something like that. But that's kind of where my head's at. I think, you know, you mentioned it with Driscoll making a lot of sense. Cleveland, again, that's a guy where I think Packers fans are getting Jason Spriggs PTSD, which I totally get. Mm-hmm. Just a freakazoid athlete that has some struggles on tape, who doesn't look like he's ready, and Spriggs just never got there. And that's somebody that they moved up and lost draft capital to take. And I understand some of the concerns there. How about this linebacker crew? Because I am really starting to think that it's flatter than what I thought right away. And that's because, I think everybody really early in the process was excited about Patrick Queen, excited about Kenneth Murray. And then there were some questions, you know, your Malik Harrison or Troy Dye, maybe Jordan Brooks, maybe Logan Wilson, the kid from Wyoming, as far as who's linebacker three and okay, when does that player go? After watching a lot of the tape, though, Patrick Queen has, I would say, certainly some questions. I mean, didn't really get on the field until late in the year. Obviously, had a coaching staff that coming out of fall camp was not super impressed with his work. I like some of the tape. That's fine. But, man, you watch Murray, he was asked to do very little. I mean, I don't think I saw a drop into the middle of a cover two scheme or really take man on man with a tight end and try to shut him down. I mean, he was moving side to side or he was moving forward. And that's not to say that he can't cover and that he can't drop. He can't do these things. It's just, it's not there. It's not on film. And for me, I love Troy Dye. You know, I like him and like moving him up A lot of guys really like Akeem Davis-Gaither, and there, you've got your Jordan Brooks guys, and our friend Mark Jarvis is a huge Logan Wilson guy. Let's talk about the Blake Martinez role, because it's a huge role for the Packers, and they felt comfortable moving on and handing the baton to Christian Kirksey. And in Green Bay, I mean, they're going to play one linebacker, and he's going to play every snap if he can stay healthy and play every snap. On early downs, he'll have another linebacker next to him. And on second and long and third down, it's probably going to be some sort of hybrid safety. Like right now what's on the roster is Raven Green. Maybe they bring in a Jeremy Chinn or a Kyle Duggar, a bigger freak athlete safety to try and play maybe that hybrid spot. They kind of whiffed with Josh Jones from NC State, really hoping he'd be that guy. Talk to me about fits in this linebacker group for that Blake Martinez role.
Yeah, what an interesting linebacker group. Had almost no buzz, you know, back in the beginning of January. Then Patrick Queen declares, and I had seen Patrick Queen live a bunch, and I, you know, this time I'm watching it kind of as a fan. I was, like I said, I wasn't even really scouting, and I was just like, man, this number 8 can ball. Like, I was just like amazed at how well he played. And I knew his name, and I was just like, man, no, I haven't heard anyone talk about him. So I like tweeted a couple things out, and then like he declares, and I was like, man, I didn't hear anybody even thinking he would declare. And then all of a sudden he's in first round mocks, and I'm like, whoa. So I got to go to the tape. I'm studying him. Then once I jump back into the field, and I'm like, man, his tape is just awesome. Like he's in the top 50. I think he's 15 on my board, something like that. I love him. I think he's great. I think he has all the tools to be successful in the NFL. Got to tackle a little bit better. Got to get off blocks a little bit better. Two things that you'll say about just about every linebacker every year when they come out. It's just, everybody's like, I don't know. He can't get off. I don't care if he beats blockers to spots. That's how you play linebacker in today's NFL. Every linebacker is going to get smacked by a guard once in a while. Like it's just the way the league is. They don't have these dudes. LaVon Kirkland's not out there anymore. Like these guys are going to struggle to get off blocks from guys that weigh 70 to 100 more pounds than them these days. You know, it's just going to happen. And so I don't get really super caught up in that. Love to see it when it happens. And we'll get to Malik Harrison in a second because I love watching him play football. But it's not a big issue for me with Patrick Queen. Yeah, and he misses some tackles. Everybody does. When you're around the ball all the time, you miss some tackles. But he's not a bad tackler by any stretch, and he's not a tackler who, you know, physicality-wise, you worry about him at all. The awareness and coverage, the playmaking ability, dude doesn't hesitate. He plays the position fast. That's what I want in a linebacker. So I love Patrick Queen. I've been a huge fan of him the whole process. Just watch Zach Bond. I really was impressed with Zach Bond. I think he is going to have to move from the edge to play off ball. I don't know if he's going to fit the Blake Martinez type of role. I think actually I checked that. I think he can probably adjust and learn anything. It's impossible for me to say what that learning curve will be like because he doesn't play off the ball at Wisconsin hardly at all. So, you know, I think that there will be an adjustment period for him, but good athlete, instinctive, just kind of gets it, how to move, how to avoid blockers, gets off blocks better than you'd expect for a guy that's undersized to play edge. I think he was 238 and had the diluted sample. He said he was packing on water weight. So again, like I don't care about his weight because I think he's going to play off ball linebacker. So, and he'll edge rush situationally, great speed bend guy, not much else. So he's not going to play there full time. But I mean, he was standing up tackles in the Big Ten, you know, at that weight, whatever he's playing at, 230, 233, whatever it is. He's standing him up and stacking and shedding at the edge. So I like Zach Bond. I think he's really good. He's going to be a really good football player in the NFL. Don't know if he's the best fit or not. Malik Harrison is just a blast to watch play football. I mean, he is a throwback linebacker in size, length, physicality, playing style, but he's also tested great and nobody talked about it. He tested awesome and he had a good Senior Bowl in coverage. You know, he's not going to be kicking the slot and match up with a wide receiver one-on-one or a tight end one-on-one. Like that's not his game, but middle of the field, deep zones type of coverage, you know, he has ball skills and awareness. And I think he's just a smart, physical, aggressive football player. He gets himself out of position once in a while chasing something, but I mean, I think those things can be overlooked. I just like the way he plays the game a lot. Much more of a natural football player than Kenneth Murray is. And Murray has all this upside in the world, and I totally get it. I like watching him play too because he's so fast and physical, but it's just so hit or miss mentally, like you were saying. Like there's just so little asked of him. It's hard to know how instinctive and he's going to be at the next level, and I just have a lot of questions with Murray, I think. I just don't see a I don't see a great linebacker yet. I think he's a good football, like he has good football playing ability, I think, but I don't see, like, linebacker's a mental position. You have to be able to read and key and react, and you have to have some level of instincts to you, and I don't know that that's there. Now, it could be an Oklahoma scheme. It wasn't allowed to flow free, so we'll see kind of what ends up happening with him. If he goes first round, I think I would just be a little bit queasy about that. I'm not sure he's going to need great coaching at the next level, I think, to maximize what he offers. And then there's other guys. I mean, I haven't even finished the linebacker group. I have to finish Akeem Davis Gaither, Logan Wilson, Marcus Bailey, Jordan Brooks, and Troy Dye this weekend probably. But I, like I said, Troy Dye, I kind of agree with you that down the seam, I mean, he covered in coverage for Oregon. That's been his like bread and butter. I mean, he's shown the ability to find the football, play it, has the athleticism to run. So I kind of like him too. And I see him consistently in the day three range. And I'm just like, man, I think that's going to be a good player in that range. It may never be a great run defender, but you can live with that in today's NFL. Jordan Brooks gets all the love for his run defense. I'm excited to watch him. I've seen him start to sneak into round one mocks. Willie Gay is another guy I have to finish up. I've seen enough to know. I mean, I know we're dealing with one of the best athletes at the position ever. So that's a great place to start from. I wish he would have been on the field more for Mississippi State. And I don't know that the academic issue and stuff like that are going to bother teams too much if he interviews well. So I can't speak to whether he can handle the mental workload or any of that stuff, or if he's the character or whatever, but a guy that freakishly athletic and has that kind of splash playability, I'd probably find a way to draft him if I could. So I like the linebacker class a lot from what I've seen. I'm going to finish the group up here before the draft, and I'm excited about it. But we haven't mentioned Josh Uche, who I think will probably be a linebacker who has really good movement skills, and talk about coverage down the seam. He did some good things at Michigan too. So I think it's a good group, and I don't think you have to draft a guy in round one to find a good player. There's going to be guys in round two and three, and maybe a couple in round four that'll help you too.
Yeah, Uche is interesting to me, as is Bond. You know, I think a lot of this too, we talk about fit. I talk about creativity. Who ends up with Isaiah Simmons? Who ends up with Zach Bond? Who ends up with Josh Uche? Okay, and then what do you do with those guys? You know, how do you use them? A guy that I remember, Uchenna Nwosu from just a couple classes ago, I thought would have been a phenomenal guy to put in the Uche Bond role. Hassan Reddick is a guy that hasn't worked out, frankly, who really, I think, got gassed up in the pre-draft process and rose vertically, I think, after the combine. And as people found his tape and just it hasn't quite been there. So those guys are interesting. But, yeah, how do you use a Jeremy Chinn? Where do you put a Kyle Duggar? Are you creative enough to use these guys in ways that they can win? Another guy like that for me is Curtis Weaver, and you talk about an edge group that is mediocre at best. A guy like Weaver, who plays kind of that Za'Darius Smith rover gap shooting role, I think has a lot of value. Where do you stand on Weaver as a prospect? Because he's got some really weird film.
He is the strangest film. I mean, he's one of the strangest players I've watched this draft process. I ended up being low on him. I might get a chance to revisit him and maybe I'll change my mind. I watched a couple games and I just like, I don't see guys win like this in the NFL. That's always what I look for, is like, okay, I watched so much NFL tape. And then I say, okay, how do these guys win? Can they win that way in the NFL? And I just don't know if a guy can win with as little physicality as he has of the position. I don't know what he even does. He just kind of slips around everybody. I mean, and yeah. He played horrible offensive linemen. I mean, Florida State was their kind of out of conference game against a bigger opponent, and their offensive lines might be the worst I've seen in the FBS. I mean, he just didn't face anybody that really even knew how to pass protect in the games that I saw, at least. So, you know, I just was like, maybe I'll be wrong and I'll take a huge L, but I'm just not sure that the way he wins is kind of just sliding around people and, you know, slipping through gaps. He's pretty quick feet and he's just kind of dancing all over the place, and he makes guys punch first and then kind of dances around them. And it's a very, very unique tape watch. I don't know that I've seen anybody I would even compare him to be honest, just because it's so unique. But the other thing that struggles with Weaver is that he doesn't move well. I know he tested actually okay, I think, for his position, but his weight, I mean, he's not going to be a guy the teams want to drop into space. And he played a lot from a 2-point stance, and his 2-point stance is kind of ugly. So what's his 3-point stance going to look like if he gets down in that? Or will teams have him stand up and just don't care about the fact that he won't drop? And, you know, he doesn't really play in space very well, and he doesn't defend the run really well at the point of attack. So you have to kind of weigh all that in terms of, you may love what he can do as a pass rusher, but do you love it enough to think that NFL teams are going to put him on the field with the other weaknesses? You know, that's part of the difficulty in weighing a player like him, is that you may think, you know, he does this pretty well. Like, I think he can be a situational edge rusher. Well, okay, but in today's NFL, everybody's trying to find two guys that can start, that can rush the passer on the edge. You know, if he could kick inside and rush, that's a different story. Then you have some value there. But I'm just not sure if he's physical enough to do that, to kick inside and win there. I don't know. So he is a hard player to figure out. You're right. He was very weird to watch. I ended up blowing him. Hopefully I get a chance to revisit and look at some things before the draft happens. But I was late to get into this class, so I'm not sure if I'll have time or not.
Yeah, I understand that for sure. It is. It's a tough eval. I think it's certainly something that I don't know if I've seen. I know, like, our guy Mike Renner is really high on him, and they're so tape based and kind of move away from the athleticism. But like you said, I mean, he drafted, you know, talk about Kentley Plattie's RAS. He was a 7'2 guy, you know, 72nd percentile athlete, had a 7'3" cone. You like that for pass rushers. And I think, you know, eventually you just have to be creative to use a lot of these guys. I've mentioned a number of names where if you try and just plug them in to your base defense and you don't adjust anything that you do to bring out their strengths, you've got guys that'll, you know, potentially even wash out of the league. Guys that not necessarily obviously Isaiah Simmons, but guys like a Curtis Weaver or like a Jeremy Chinn, where if they're not used in a creative way that plays to their strengths, I think they bring fourth or fifth round value instead of second round value, where they darn sure might go. All right, John, let's get straight into the viewer or listener questions, just because we're kind of not necessarily running long on time, but we want to give these the time that they deserve. From Green 19, who does John think are the best draft fits for the Packers on the O-line and on the D-line? So we've already kind of taken care of the offensive line questions, unless you have an interior guy that you like for Green Bay. But how about those defensive linemen? I mean, you did mention that you did not particularly love this class, especially after Brown and Kinlaw, who I don't think they'll be there.
Right. Yeah, I don't. And, you know, I'll touch offensive line just really quickly. I think that Ben Bredesen is a player who deserves more love from Michigan, their left guard, because he's so good in pass protection. And no, he's not like a dominant run blocker, but he's not like getting tossed around in the run game either. Like, I don't think he's a liability. He's just not like a difference maker in the run game. And he is in pass protection. I just think those kind of guys matter in today's NFL. So I would definitely throw his name out there as a possibility for the interior line. Interior defensive line, yeah, it's tough, man. I mean, Matty Beak from Texas A&M, who I may not be even saying his name right, but he is probably my number three guy. Late second, early third round type of grade for him. You know, good player at times and spurts for games, and also disappears for spurts, not physically dominant for sure. Needs to be in a role kind of that's going to allow him to use his athleticism. I think his stance will need fixed up a little bit, but you see the flashes of pass rush moves, and that's kind of what I'm hoping I get with him. You know, none of these guys are great pass rushers. Nobody. I mean, even I love Javon Kinlaw to death, and even he needs like some work as a pass rusher. You know, Derek Brown, I think that's maybe his biggest weakness, is that there's just not a great pass rush plan in his game right now. But I mean, all, like, you're just looking for guys that can move and have potential. So Matty Beak, Blacklock from TCU, and Gallimore from Oklahoma all have that kind of athleticism. Elliott may be a little bit more polished, but I don't see the explosiveness with Elliott that other people do. So I think those guys can all play, and, you know, sometime on day two, you know, probably later day two for me, I'm okay with all of them. You know, I think that they can all help a team, but I don't think you're getting a difference maker in this defensive line class after those first two guys. I think you'll get guys that can play, that will help your team, but there's nobody that's going to be like an impact stud that you're like getting thrilled about adding to the D-line.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Even some of the guys like the Blacklocks and Gallimores that you do see, I don't think, you know, that's where Green Bay took Kenny Clark at 30. And if you think you're getting Kenny Clark at 30 this year, you're just not. And obviously in a redraft, Kenny Clark would have gone in the top 10. But my point is that you're right. I mean, I don't see these super high upside guys like a Kenny Clark. All right, we all have, from Ken, we all have a player or two we really want the Packers to draft in the first round. What do you expect they will do compared to what you want them to do? I'll take this one. So what I think they will do is probably an offensive player. I think a lot of people are tying them to Denzel Mims. He might be gone. Ayuk, I think the Packers love drafting from the West Coast forever. Kenny Clark, Aaron Rodgers, Clay Matthews, I can go on and on, Pac-12 players. Devontae Adams is Fresno State, which isn't the Pac-12, but it's still West Coast. David Bakhtiari played in the Pac-12. They love that side of the country. I think it's because they really trust their West Coast scout, Sam Seal. I think he makes a ton of sense. I think if it's not that, it'll probably, in my opinion, which will kind of throw people off a little bit, I think it'll be a corner. I could see Jalen Johnson, Utah from out west. I could certainly see a guy like AJ Terrell, who people are underestimating because he got beat up in the national championship game by probably a top 10 pick next year, in Jamar Chase. A lot of those plays, he was in phase. He just had the best college quarterback in the last 5 years, working with one of the better receivers that we've seen at that level in the last 5 years. So, yeah, a perfect throw and a perfect catch are going to beat even a first-round corner. Mm-hmm. But they've got Tremont Williams, who may or may not come back. You've got Kevin King, who may or may not work out. So it's probably a tackle, a wide receiver, or a corner. What do I want them to do? I want them to draft LaVisca Chenault, but I don't think I'm going to get my way on that.
I think drafting a wide receiver, though.
Even to have – sorry, I did something the other day. If you count edge players as defensive linemen, since they took A.J. Hawk in 2006, the Packers have either taken an offensive tackle, a defensive lineman, a safety, or a corner in the draft. That's it, in the first round, period. So no off-the-ball linebackers, no receivers, no tight ends, no interior offensive linemen, no quarterbacks, and no running backs, period, in 14 years. Defensive line, corner, safety, offensive tackle, if you count edge rushers as that position. So you definitely can see what they want to do, but what makes sense for them, you know, I don't know, as far as Rodgers kind of verbally saying, hey, you know, we've never taken a receiver in the first round of my career. That'd be cool. It was something that Green Bay did when they took Javon Walker from Florida State towards the end of Favre's career. They really tried to kind of figure that out. So, yeah, I think that makes sense. All right, here's one for you, John. And then we'll kind of wrap things up. Who is your NFL comparison for Mims?
Man, that's a tough question.
It is tough.
The comparison that kept coming to me when I was watching him was Devontae Parker, because I think that there's so much ability and talent there, but it just does not consistently show up on the field. Like, there is just you should not be as big, as strong, and as athletic as these guys, and they're getting bodied by corners like Gladney and Motley from Oklahoma that are smaller than them, and you know they're out competing them at the catch point. And it's so funny because when I watched highlights of Mims and, like, you know, college football and stuff on Saturdays or whatever, and everybody would talk about this Mims guy, it was always some crazy contested catch or sideline catch. Yeah. And he has crazy good ball skills. There's no doubt about it, but it's not consistent. There's no aspect of Mims games that is consistent. So to me, it was like frustrating. And at times it was like, there's effort wise, like, is he trying to separate? Like, is he selling these route breaks? Is he going through the motions? I questioned that when I watched him on tape, and I don't say that lightly, but, and that's, I think, was Parker. Like, there was just no fire sometimes, you know. I actually, years ago when I was first starting out, was when Parker came out. And again, like, there were times where, like, he looked like unbelievable on tape, and then there were reps where he would disappear for an extended amount of time. And I ended up betting on Parker's upside and took 5 years, but I think I was right, maybe. I think that Mims, I have a late second on him. I don't know if I was too scared to trust his raw ability, because he's an absolute freak athlete, freak. I mean, he's freak. He just is. Like, his ceiling through the roof. I don't know if I'm too scared to go higher or too much of a coward to, you know, say, look, his tape is not his tape is not round two caliber. I don't know how anybody can say his tape's round two caliber, in my opinion. Like, I just think that there's just way too many issues against, you know, Big 12 corners. Like, you got to be looking like CeeDee Lamb and at that point. I am just too scared, I guess, to trust him more than that. So I just went right in the middle of where I feel like he probably should be, and just kind of, maybe it's like a cowardly grade on him in some ways, but I just can't justify putting somebody with those kind of traits and the kind of peak plays that he has on tape any lower than that. But also the inconsistencies kept me from putting him higher. So I do think, you know, it could be a guy where, like, you're just pounding your head against the wall for the first couple of years in the NFL. And then all of a sudden, I mean, DeVante Parker was unbelievable last season. He was amazing. He was like the only dude who just punked Stephon Gilmore last year. I mean, it just, so that's what I'm talking about with Mims, is that he has the ability to go match up with a corner who's one of the best in the league. And we even saw it at the Senior Bowl. He thrashed people at the Senior Bowl. If he had played like that at Baylor, he would probably be the number one wide receiver in the class. I mean, that's just reality. Like, he's that talented, but he didn't play like that. And I don't know whether he will play like that at the next level. So he is probably, I would say he and Rager were the two most frustrating wide receiver evaluations for me. And Mims probably would be number one in that regard, just because I wanted to, like, put him as my, you know, I wanted to put him up high, but more and more games I watched, it wasn't enough there to justify it. But then I kept going back to Senior Bowl tape and being like, man, this guy might be a monster if he puts it all together.
So, yeah, I mean, that's something too, where it would drive Packers fans nuts, because they want it now. And right. There are guys, like I mentioned, the gadgety guys, the Ayukes, the Ragers, the Chenaults, they'll win right away in the way that they win, which is in space, breaking tackles, making guy miss. You don't have to learn how to do that. Look at Deebo Samuel. With a guy like Mims, where he's a sideline technician, a freak athlete that maybe needs to learn a few things, and might be one of the best 10 receivers in the league in 2022. That's scary, I think, for Packers fans, and I totally get it. All right, we have successfully run ourselves all the way out of time. John, I really want to thank you for your time, buddy. This was phenomenal. I want to thank again our title sponsor, Stadium View Bar, Grill, and Banquet Hall. I want to thank all you Packers fans for listening. Really appreciate that. All right, everybody, until next time, go Pack, go.